majority of people on this planet, was just fine. It was the rest of her body that felt foreign to her. She had been betrayed by it before, but in a much different way. It had been 10 years ago, when she was still living with a woman who, like a tide, was wearing her away at the edges. She pretended she was happy, but what she really meant was that she was settled. That this was easier than wondering, again, if there would ever be anyone for her. Then she had gone to a faculty mixer at the university to celebrate the start of the new year. Her partner didn't come. She hated these things, where no one seemed to ask the right questions about her and her career designing, as she called them, workable kitchens. But weren't they all? So Olive had attended alone, planning to stay just long enough to be seen by the head of the department and then go home and indulge in a glass of wine or maybe a bottle. But then she noticed a woman at the bar with long hair, so long that it was unfashionable, like a 70s flashback, like Lady Godiva, Olive thought, as she watched the woman throw back 3 shots of bourbon and ask the bartender for a 4th.
You okay? Olive asked her.
Yes. On the other hand, Peg replied, the dean of the engineering school is a misogynistic dick.
Olive didn't answer. She, who had never cheated and had never wanted to, was watching Peg's lips form the words, mesmerized.
Oh, fuck, Peg said. You're his wife, aren't you?
Nope. Not even close. She moved closer and rested her elbow on the bar. Did you know that drinking doesn't actually make you forget anything? When you're blackout drunk, the brain just temporarily loses its ability to make memories.
Does that line ever work? Peg asked.
Don't know. I'm road testing it.
Peg laughed. So, if I keep up this pace, I might not remember meeting you?
That's about right. She pushed away that last shot glass and held out her hand to introduce herself. Now, Olive buried her face in her hands. Oh, Jesus. Peg. How would she tell her? The thought chased itself around and around in her mind, like a squirrel in the eaves. Olive could feel panic closing in on her. She took a deep breath and closed her eyes and tried to remind herself that what she was feeling was perfectly normal. The brain could only hold so much. It took roughly 90 minutes to clear its proverbial cache. On the heels of that came another tidbit of knowledge, one she had often quoted when she handed back the first multiple-choice exam to groans of disappointment. Studies have shown that when presented with a list, the default of the brain is to pick whatever is first. The same holds true for voting and ballots. But sometimes there are no choices, Olive realized. What does the brain do when you've run out of options? It wasn't easy to vomit quietly, but the bathroom that Izzy had ducked into was located right off the waiting room. When she finished, she wiped her face with toilet paper and rinsed her mouth out. Then she stood there, taking a moment. The bathroom was decorated like the rest of the building, as if the art had been picked up from garage sales or worse, from the free boxes of items that didn't sell. On the wall was a photograph of what looked like the French Riviera, a technically weak oil painting of a sad clown, and a detailed, biologically correct pen and ink illustration of a shrimp. All three of them made her think of Parker. Last weekend, his parents had come to visit and had taken them out to a meal that cost half of what she made in a week. It was one of those steak and seafood houses where the food was airlifted in from the North Sea or a ranch in New Zealand, where you could keep a private wine cellar with your own special vintage. Parker's father had ordered a seafood tower for the table that looked like a wedding cake. Tiers of oysters and mussels, ribbons of smoked mackerel and bluefish dip, buttons of sweet baby scallops crowned by a whole lobster. It was dazzling, excessive, and completely out of Izzy's purview. Parker's mother talked about the work she did with the hospital auxiliary, and Parker's father asked Izzy all sorts of questions, like whether she always wanted to be a nurse and where she went to school. They talked about their recent trip to Paris and asked Izzy if she had ever been there. And when Izzy said no, they said they hoped she and Parker could come along next time. Clearly, Parker had told them that she was important to him. She watched Parker dribble down oysters and use a fish knife and never have to stress about which plate was for the bread and which drinking glass belonged to him. When Izzy still had to stick her hands under the table and form a lowercase B and D with her left and right hands to remind herself, the things that were instinctual to him were foreign to her, and vice versa. She doubted that Parker had ever had to gauge if moldy bread could still be consumed without making him sick. She was certain he had never fished a half-finished sandwich from the trash to eat, or gone into the laundromat to feel in the machines for quarters others left behind. She could tell he sensed her unease, because every now and then he would reach for her hand and squeeze it underneath the tablecloth. He put a small collection of seafood on her plate so she wouldn't have to worry about whether it was completely gauche to pick up a mussel shell with her fingers. There was no denying that he calmed her. When his thumb rubbed over her knuckles absentmindedly, she could breathe more easily. She let him coax her into the conversation as if it were a frigid pool. She got so comfortable that for a moment, she forgot who she had been. Parker's father told a stupid dad joke, just like the ones her own father used to tell.
"What do you call it when you feed dynamite to a steer?" "Abominable. Get it? Say it slowly."
Parker's mother slapped him lightly on the shoulder and rolled her eyes. "For God's sake, Tom, you'll scare her off." It felt so normal, so similar to her own parents' behavior, that she made the mistake of thinking she and Parker actually did have common ground. Laughing, she lifted a shrimp from her plate and took a bite. It crunched, which was weird. But then lots of food rich people liked was weird. Caviar, pate, raw beef. It wasn't until she noticed Parker's parents staring at her that she realized her mistake. She'd never had a shrimp in her life. How was she supposed to know to peel the shell? "Excuse me," she muttered, and she fled to the ladies' room. She hid there, thinking about telling Parker about the pregnancy test she had taken. If he knew she was pregnant, he would never let her go. She was doing what was best for him. Even if he thought Izzy was what he wanted right now, it was only a matter of time before he decided he'd rather be with someone from the same background as him. Someone who'd eaten shrimp before, for God's sake.
"Is?"
It was Parker's voice. "You're in the ladies' room," she said.
"Am I? Damn."
He paused.
"You gonna come out?"
"No."
"Ever?"
"No." A woman walked into the bathroom and squeaked.
"Sorry, can you give us a minute?"
Parker asked. Izzy heard the door open and the buzz of the restaurant before it got quiet again.
"You know what? I fucking hate shrimp. It's like eating something prehistoric," he said. "The point is, I don't care."
I do.
That was it, in a nutshell.
Parker, go back to your parents.
There's nothing you can say that's going to make this any better.
Nothing?
Parker replied. She heard shuffling and shifting, and then Parker's hand slipped under the stall door, his fist opening like a blossom to reveal a diamond ring.
Izzy, he said, will you marry me?
Only one other woman had been in the recovery room when Joy was brought in. She wore an Ole Miss sweatshirt and pool shoes, and she was crying.
You have a seat in that chair, honey, the nurse said, flicking a glance at the other patient.
Harriet handed Joy a juice box and a packet of Fig Newtons. You got your azithromycin? Joy nodded. Good. You take that as directed. You can also take Motrin or Advil in 2 hours. But no aspirin, okay? It thins the blood. And here's a prescription for Sprintec. That's the birth control you picked, right? Joy nodded absently. She couldn't stop staring at the other woman, who was sobbing so hard that Joy felt rude for intruding on someone's visible grief. What did it say about Joy, who wasn't crying? Was this the proof that she had been looking for? That she would have been a lousy mother?
Will you excuse me a second? Harriet said.
And she went over to the woman's chair and put a hand on her shoulder.
Are you all right? Are you in pain?
The woman shook her head, past speech.
Are you sad that you had to make this decision?
Who wasn't? Joy thought. What hellish tributary of evolution had made reproduction, and all the shit that came with it, the woman's job? She thought about all the women who had sat in the very chair she was in, and the stories that had brought them here, and how, for one brief chapter, they all intersected. A sisterhood of desperation. The woman took a Kleenex from a box that Harriet offered her.
Sometimes, we have to make choices when we don't like any of the options, the nurse said.
She drew the woman into an embrace.
You've been here long enough. I can get your driver, if you're ready to go.
A few minutes later, the woman was signed out. A boy, he really was no more than that, stood awkwardly beside her as she got up and started to walk down the hall. He put his hand on her shoulder, but she shrugged it off, and Joy watched them until she couldn't see them anymore, moving in tandem with 6 fixed inches of distance between them. Joy put in her earbuds and filled her head with music. Had anyone asked, she would have said she was listening to Beyoncé or Lana Del Rey, but the truth was she was listening to music from The Little Mermaid. At one of her foster homes, she had been given that CD as a birthday gift and had memorized every last word of it. When things got really bad, she used to put the pillow over her head and whisper the lyrics.
Wouldn't you think I'm a girl? A girl who has everything.
Ms. Joy, the nurse said, let's get some vitals. She came and stood beside Joy's oversized armchair in the recovery room. Joy let Harriet stick the thermometer into her mouth and Velcro the cuff around her arm. She watched the red numbers blink on the machine, proof that her body, battered as it was still functional. 110 over 75 and 98.6, the nurse said.
Normal.
Normal. Nothing was normal. The whole world had changed. She had had 2 hearts, and now she did not. She had been a mother, and now she was not. George sat in his truck, his hands fisted on the steering wheel, going nowhere. The ignition was off, and he had 2 choices.
he could start the engine again and drive back home and pretend he'd never come, or he could finish what he'd started. He was breathing heavily, like he'd run here, instead of driving hundreds of miles to distance himself from a truth he couldn't absorb. He thought about how he and Lil had once been part of a 30 Days for Life vigil with the church, where the congregation took shifts round the clock, huddled in a prayer circle in front of the state capitol. They had brought blankets and lawn chairs and thermoses of hot chocolate, and had held hands and asked Jesus to help lawmakers see the right path. Lil had been a child, maybe 8 or 9, and she and some other kids in the congregation had run around while the adults prayed. He could remember watching them spell out their names with sparklers in the dark and thinking this was what the movement for life was all about. How could Lil have gotten an abortion? She had to have been pressured. Someone here must have told her this was the right thing, the only thing to do. She couldn't have possibly believed that he wouldn't have helped her, raised the child, done anything she wanted. In the back of his mind was a thought like a worm in the core of an apple. What if this was what she wanted? George didn't believe it. He couldn't. She was a good girl, because he had been a good father. If the first half of that statement wasn't true, didn't it negate the second half? Lil had accepted Jesus Christ as her Lord and Savior. She knew that life began at conception. She could probably rattle off 5 Bible verses proving it. She was kind, generous, beautiful, smart, and everyone fell in love with her when they met her. Lil was, quite simply, the one instance of perfection in George's life. He realized, of course, that everyone was a sinner, but if there was any splinter of evil in his daughter, he knew where it had come from. Him. George, who had spent nearly 2 decades trying to scrub clean the stains from his soul by giving himself to the church. George, who had been told forgiveness was divine, that God loved him no matter what. What if all that had been a lie? George shook his head clear. It was this simple. Something terrible had happened. Someone was to blame for it. This was a test from God, like the one Job faced, and Abraham. He was being asked to prove his devotion to his faith and to his daughter, and he knew exactly what was expected of him. He slipped on his coat and zipped it up halfway. Then he took the pistol out of the glove compartment and tucked it into his waistband, concealing it beneath the fleece. His pockets were already full of ammunition. He started sweating almost immediately, but then again it was easily 80 degrees outside. He began moving toward the Hazard Orange building. It was garish, a scar on the cityscape. George ducked his head, pulled his collar up. There was a fence around the center, and on that perimeter was a cluster of protesters. They held up signs. There was a woman sitting in a folding chair, knitting, and a big man holding a sandwich in one hand and a baby doll in another. George thought about Lil. He wondered if he was walking the same path she had. A black woman was leaving the clinic. Her husband or boyfriend had his arm around her. As they passed the protesters, he folded her more protectively into the shell of his body. He crossed paths with the couple and kept walking. The big man eating the sandwich called out to him. "Brother," he said, "save your baby." George continued to the front door of the center, thinking, "I will." Out of sheer boredom, Wren was eavesdropping. "Dr. Ward's been at it since 9:30, Vanita was saying. "We had a 15-week come in for cytotech this morning, and she's in the back now." "All that while I was sitting home eating bonbons?" The girl with pink hair laughed. "Bonbons," Vanita sighed. "I wish." She took a sip from her tumbler. What's in there?
I hope it's ground up bones of supermodels, Vanita said sourly. This crap is the work of the devil.
Why do you even drink that garbage?
Vanita gestured to her generous curves. Because of my torrid love affair with food.
Aunt Bex stood up.
I think I'm growing roots, she said, starting to walk in small circles. How long can it take to give someone a prescription? Wren watched her lift her arms over her head, bend at the waist, and do it over again. Oh my God. Her aunt was doing old person yoga in public. A buzzer hummed on the reception desk, and Vanita glanced up over her reading glasses.
Now, who does this one belong to? She mused.
Wren craned her neck. The glass window in the door of the center was specially made so that they could see out, but whoever was on the outside could not see in. She glimpsed a middle-aged man squinting into the mirrored surface. She heard a click, the buzz of a lock being released, like Wren had seen in movies about New York apartments.
Can I help you? Vanita said.
About a year ago, Wren and her father had been driving a deserted road near Chunky, Mississippi, when suddenly all the hair stood up on the back of her neck. The next minute, a doe had bolted from the woods and slammed into the car. They had been hit hard enough for the airbags to deploy and for the windshield to shatter. It was the only truly prescient moment of her life. Until now. Wren felt a shiver of electricity, the brush of an invisible icy finger.
What did you do to my baby?
The man said, and then the air around her cracked into pieces. She fell to the floor, covering her ears. It was as if her body had reacted on instinct, while her brain was still struggling to catch up. She couldn't see Vanita anymore, but there was a pool of blood spreading where the reception desk met the floor. Wren tried to will herself to move, but she was frozen in ice. She was trapped in tar.
Wren,
Aunt Bex cried, reaching out her hand. To pull her up? To drag her out the door? To embrace her? Wren didn't know. Because then her aunt's eyes went wide and she was struck with a bullet. She tumbled to the floor as Wren scrambled closer, screaming, her hands shaking as they hovered over the bright blood on her aunt's blouse. Aunt Bex's eyes were wide, her mouth was open, but Wren couldn't hear any sound coming out. She read her aunt's lips. Wren. 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 Then she realized what her aunt was actually saying.
Run.
The other clinic had been nothing like this one, Janine thought. It had been in a different state, in a different life, in a part of town full of drunks and Vietnam vets fighting PTSD. There had been someone smoking a bowl in the alley next to the building, and the lobby had smelled like Chinese food. But none of the differences could make Janine shake the fact that she had willingly, once again, entered an abortion factory. Janine sat on the ultrasound table, her phone tucked in a pocket of her dress, where it was taping the entire conversation between her and the social worker. Her name was Graciela, and she had the most beautiful black hair Janine had ever seen. It reached her waist. By contrast, the cheap wig that Alan had given her for camouflage was itchy and brassy. Janine scratched her temple.
Still, you think I should get an abortion, right?
The social worker smiled a little.
I can't answer that for you. You'll know in your gut what to do.
But I don't.
Well, Graciela suggested, you're early, right? Only 7 weeks? Take a walk. Go outside, clear your mind. Sleep on it. Sleep on it again if you have to.
Write down what you're feeling to sort through your emotions. Scream into your pillow. Cry. Let it out. Talk to friends or family. Ultimately, the decision is all yours, Fiona.
Fiona?
Janine frowned and then remembered that was the name on the fake ID she had used at the reception desk. Graciela reached for her hand and squeezed. She was being so kind that it made Janine feel sick inside. Why wasn't she saying something incriminating? Why hadn't there been someone like Graciela when she had...
It's not about making the right choice, Graciela said. It's about making the right choice for you.
But I'm really scared, Janine said.
She needed evidence. She needed to collect proof that they coerced people into killing babies. Every woman who's ever been in your shoes has been scared, Graciela assured her. You're not alone.
My family would be so disappointed in me.
Janine felt tears burn in her eyes. Not because she was such a stellar actress, though. Because it was the truth.
It's going to be okay, Graciela promised. I know it doesn't feel that way right now, but I promised you, no matter what your decision is, it's going to be the right one.
She drew back, holding Janine at arm's length, and gestured in the direction of the ultrasound machine.
We don't have to do this today.
Janine paused, trying to figure out what to do next. She couldn't have the ultrasound without revealing that she wasn't pregnant, but she didn't want to go back to Alan empty-handed. In the silence, there was a sound, like books dropping. Then a shriek and a crash. Graciela frowned.
Will you excuse me?
She opened the door to the consultation room as Janine reached into her pocket to check the recording. Suddenly, Janine was knocked flat on her back. Dropping the phone, she struggled upright, pinned by the social worker, tangled in her river of hair. She finally freed herself as Graciela fell to the floor, landing on her belly.
Graciela?
Janine said, crouching down. She reached for the woman's shoulder and shook, and when Graciela didn't respond, she turned her over. Graciela had been shot in the face. Janine screamed, noticing for the first time the blood on her hands and her clothing. She couldn't breathe. She couldn't think. With a whimper, Janine scrambled to her feet, stepped over the body, and ran. When she was driving with Ren once, Bex had slammed on the brakes and instinctively had thrown out her right arm to protect the precious cargo in the passenger seat. The mom arm, Ren had called it. Even if her actual mom had not been especially devoted. Today, as soon as the man came in, Bex's body moved of its own accord. Something was not right. She had seen it in his body language. Sweat beaded on his forehead and matting down his hair. She had known on some visceral, cellular level, and just as when her car spun on the ice, without any conscious thought, Bex had reached toward her niece. She saw the blink of the silver pistol as he drew it from the folds of his coat. She even saw the burst of lightning from the barrel of the gun, which ripped a hole in the fabric of the room and sucked all the sound out of it. She was aware that she was watching a pantomime, that her eardrums were full of pressure and a pulsing silence. But somehow she was an actor in this show, and she had a line. Bex felt the scream stream from her throat, and even though she couldn't hear it, the man must have. He pivoted, and Bex felt herself shoved backward before she even realized that the bullet had struck.
Don't shoot, don't shoot, don't shoot, she said over and over,
even though he already had. But Bex really meant,
Don't shoot Ren.
Then Ren was leaning down over her.
Bex, get up.
Her eyes were like Hugh's. Her hair, though, that came from her mother. It brushed Bex's cheek like a fall of silk, a curtain that closed them off from the world. Last year, Bex had opened an art installation in the center of Smith Park. From the limb of a tree, she hung a tiny striped circus tent, just big enough for one. If you slipped inside, you saw an easel with a white canvas and a scatter of colored Sharpies. Before I die, Bex had painted across the top, I want to... dot, dot, dot. Over the course of 2 weeks, people who came to the park to eat lunch or skateboard or read a book had wandered inside out of curiosity and had contributed their own answers. Swim in all five oceans. Run a marathon. Fall in love. Learn Mandarin. When Bex took down the installation, she had, at the very bottom of the canvas, finished her own open sentence, painting the word, live. She stared up at Ren and imagined a parallel universe where she could still breathe, where she could still move, where she put her palm against the cheek of her beautiful girl, where she got to turn back the clock and do it over. Before Olive had retired from the university, the dean had handed down a protocol for a school shooting. Mississippi allowed concealed carry of weapons, and even if you weren't supposed to bring one onto a college campus, that didn't mean it wouldn't happen. However, as she had told Peg that night, she didn't want to have to go to work every day wondering if today would be the one she had to run, hide, fight. It was the first time she had ever felt weary of her work, and it was the first seed planted in her mind that perhaps it was time to stop teaching and to take up gardening or bread making. The world was changing. Maybe she should step aside for someone else who could not only talk about neural plasticity, but do so while escaping a maniac with a semi-automatic rifle. It hadn't sounded like a shot. That was all Olive could think as she swam up from the gauzy tunnel of her thoughts. It was like popcorn in a microwave. It wasn't until she heard a scream that she even looked up and saw a pink-haired girl race past her and out the front door. Then she looked down to find a woman bleeding on the carpet with a teenager huddled over her. There was a crash in the back of the clinic. The teenager turned, her eyes enormous.
Help!
Run. Olive stood and glanced around wildly. She could see an arm flung bonelessly past the base of the reception desk, a dark arm with a festival of gold bangle bracelets, swimming in a pool of blood. Sweet Jesus, that was Benita. Olive grabbed the girl's wrist, pulling her toward the front door, but the girl was steadfastly clinging to the woman who'd been shot. "We have to get out of here," Olive said to her.
"Not without my aunt."
Olive grimaced and tried to pull the other woman up, but even with Ren's help, they couldn't move her more than a few inches. The cry that tore from the woman's throat was a red flag that would draw the shooter again. "If we leave, we can get her an ambulance." That convinced the girl. She scrambled to her feet as Olive pulled on the door handle, but it was locked. You had to be buzzed into the clinic. Was it possible you had to be buzzed out? She threw all her slight weight into the mechanism, even pounding on the door, but it didn't give.
"We're stuck here?"
the girl asked, her voice shimmying up a scale of panic. "Hide." Olive didn't answer. She opened the first door she could find. It was a supply closet, filled with boxes on one side and cleaning supplies on the other. Olive crouched down, pulling the girl in with her, and shut the door. This was where her knowledge of the shooting protocol got fuzzy. She had left her purse in the waiting room, and with it her phone. She couldn't call 911. Should she try to barricade the door? If so, with what? She couldn't help but note that had she not been sitting in a waiting room, contemplating mortality, her life would not be in danger right now. Beside her, the girl's teeth were chattering. "I'm Olive," she whispered. "What's your name?"
Ren.
Ren, I want you to listen to me. We can't make a sound, understand? The girl nodded. "That's your aunt out there?" She jerked her head.
Is she going to die?
Olive didn't know how to answer that. She patted the girl's hand. "I'm sure the police are already on their way." In truth, she was not sure about this at all. If she had thought that the gunshots sounded like bubble wrap being stomped on, why would anyone outside the clinic even assume anything was wrong? Fight, she thought. The last step of the protocol. When your life is in imminent danger and you cannot run away or hide, take action. The directive seemed particularly relevant today. Suddenly, in the dark, there was a small rectangle of light. "You have a phone," Olive whispered with wonder. "You have a phone. Call 911. In the reflection of the screen, Ren's face was set, determined. Olive watched her thumbs fly. "I can do better than that," she said. Izzy heard what sounded like balloons bursting, and then a cry for help. She opened the bathroom door and saw a woman bleeding on the floor of the waiting room. She was conscious and clearly in pain. "What happened?"
"Shot,"
the woman ground out. Izzy pressed down on her chest. "What's your name, ma'am?" "I'm Izzy." The bullet had gone in the right side, which was good, because it most likely meant her heart was not affected.
"Bex," the woman gasped. "Need to get Ren."
"Let's take care of you first." Izzy reached onto a side table, scrabbling by feel for a box of tissues, and wadded them up to press into the wound. Within seconds, they were soaked through. "I'll be right back," she said, and she stood up. From this angle, she could see a second victim, Vanita, the clinic owner. Izzy started toward her and then saw the open, vacant eyes. The blood pooled beneath her head. There was nothing she could do. Izzy ran into the bathroom and pulled the little decorative shelf from the wall. She smashed it into the paper towel holder so that it cracked open, and the wad of towels fell like an accordion around her feet. Gathering them, she rushed back to Bex, using these to soak up the blood. With every subsequent gunshot she heard, Izzy's limbs became more liquid. It was only by doing something rote, taking care of a patient, that Izzy was able to keep herself from falling apart. She needed to get out of here, and it needed to be now. But Bex was a large woman, and Izzy couldn't lift her alone. She could save herself, but that would mean leaving Bex behind. Or she could help Bex, stabilize her wound with bandages. But if she went to get those, she was risking her own life and Bex's, because someone had to stay and apply pressure to the wound. What she needed, really, was someone to help. Just as Janine turned the corner and saw the mecca of the center's front door, she saw a dead woman, the clinic owner. She gasped, scrambling away from the body, and when another hand gripped her, she screamed like a banshee. She opened her eyes and saw a woman with a frizzy red braid and blood streaking her scrubs. "Listen to me," she said. "I'm a nurse and I need your help.
This woman needs your help.
She nodded toward another lady lying with a pool of blood staining the floor beneath her right shoulder. Janine could barely force out the words.
But there's a shooter.
I know. I also know that she could bleed out. I need to get supplies to help her. Please, just press down where my hand is. I promise it will only take a minute, and then you can go.
Janine looked at the door. The nurse followed her gaze.
You could save your own life, the nurse said, or you could save hers too.
If the only lives Janine cared about were those of the unborn, that would make her a hypocrite. She got to her knees beside the nurse, who positioned her hands against the wound.
I'm Izzy. What's your name?
Janine.
This is Bex, she said. Press hard. Just like that, she was gone, leaving Janine with her hands pushing hard on the chest of a stranger. Bex was staring up at her.
Am I hurting you?
Janine asked. The woman shook her head.
You should go.
She jerked her chin up toward the door. Janine realized that this woman was giving her a literal out, a way to rescue herself. If she left now, she'd survive. She just might not be able to live with herself. She settled more firmly, covering one of her hands with the other, the way Izzy had shown her. Blood welled between her fingers.
Bex? Janine asked, smiling as if she weren't terrified. Do you pray?
George was gasping for air, as if he'd run a 4-minute mile. He leaned against the wall, hands shaking. This had to be done, and he knew God would forgive him. It was right there in Isaiah chapter 43, verse 25. I, even I, am he who blots out your transgressions for my own sake and remembers your sins no more. But there was a difference between the righteous anger that had accompanied him on his long drive and the actual feeling of the pistol recoiling in his hand when he shot. And even though he knew it was ridiculous, the recoil seemed harder when his bullet struck flesh versus when it only struck plaster. When he looked down, his jeans were spattered with blood. Well, he wasn't the one who'd spilled it first. There was no way anyone could claim that he didn't have a moral high ground. He couldn't undo what had been done to Lil, but he could have retribution. He could teach them the lesson he had not been able to teach her. Life is something only God should give and take.
George looked down again at the pistol in his hand. He had forgotten what it was like to watch someone die. In Bosnia, that man who struck his head on the curb had grabbed at George's arm and stared into his eyes as if there were a cord stretched between them, and as long as he didn't blink, he would be able to stay in this world. It had been the same when he opened fire at the clinic and struck the receptionist. He had seen her eyes the moment they went dark, like a candle at the end of its wick. The second woman he shot, well, that was an accident. He hadn't even noticed her when he walked inside. He had only looked at the front desk and what was beyond it. But when she started yelling, he had to shut her up. He had to. His body had just taken over. George told himself this was no different from being a soldier. In war, killing wasn't murder. It was a mission. Today he fought for the army of God. Angels weren't always messengers. They could destroy a city with a twitch of the hand. Sometimes violence was necessary to remind the fallen of God's power. If people didn't lose his grace every now and then, they wouldn't realize how lucky they were when they had it. Still, George wondered if the angels who had flattened Sodom and Gomorrah, or the one who had killed Sennacherib's army, had trouble sleeping at night.
He wondered if they saw the faces of the dead everywhere. When he'd shot the woman in the waiting room, she had stepped forward like a sacrifice.
"I am doing this for you," he thought,
catching his daughter's name between his teeth as he wrenched himself forward.
"I am doing this for you."
When Beth was little, she would throw couch pillows on the floor and pretend the world was lava and she had to jump from island to island. Now that she was older, the world was still a boiling soup of injustice, and Beth was just trying to get through it as best she could. She had never felt so alone in her life, but that was her own fault. She thought about how, when she wrapped it in the towel, it had a soft, slight weight. It was the first time she had ever thought of it as something real instead of abstract. When Beth closed her eyes, she could still see the blue translucence of its skin, the road map of circulation, the shadows of its organs. Her pulse began to race, and a moment later, Jayla, the nurse, came into the room. She pushed a button on a monitor.
"Is my father back?"
Beth asked. Jayla shook her head. When Beth had first come in, Jayla had held her hand, stroked her brow. There seemed to be a barrier between them now, and Beth bit her lower lip. Even when she wasn't trying, she seemed to screw things up. Just then, two policemen filled the doorframe.
"Nathan?"
Jayla swayed toward one of the cops, a question caught in that one word. He shook his head the tiniest bit and then turned.
"You're Beth?"
She drew her knees to her chest, afraid to look at him.
"You're being charged with homicide for the killing of an unborn child."
Beth had already felt the bottom drop out of her world. It was a shock to realize that had been a false landing, that she had further to fall. She tried to put together the pieces, but they didn't fit. She was in a hospital. She had lost so much blood. She had almost died. The only people who even knew she had been pregnant were medical personnel. She turned to Jayla, shocked.
"You called the police?"
she said.
"What was I supposed to do?" she exploded. "You claimed you weren't pregnant, but you had so much HCG in your blood, that couldn't be true unless you just delivered. So there was a chance a newborn was out there somewhere."
"What about patient confidentiality?" Beth said.
"HIPAA doesn't matter if a life is in danger,"
Jayla answered. Her eyes suddenly swam with tears.
"You have the right to remain silent," Nathan said. "Anything you say can and will be used against you in a court of law. You have the right to an attorney. If you cannot afford an attorney, one will be provided for you."
The second policeman stepped forward and handcuffed Beth's right arm to the rail of the hospital bed.
"Help! Daddy! Help!"
Wren must have written 50 times to her father, but he wasn't answering. She knew he would save her. He always did. There was the birthday party at the bowling alley when her hand was about to be crushed between two balls, and he pretty much leaped over a table, a metal divider, and a bachelorette party to stick his own hand in the gap. There was the month she was certain there was an alien living in her bedroom closet when he diligently slept on the floor beside her bed. There was the banana bike race she had competed in at age 8 when her brakes failed and she was careening down a hill into a street with traffic. Somehow, her father had caught up and plucked her off the seat with one arm a hot second before it became a pretzel. "Dad reflexes," he called it. She just thought it was love.
"Help,"
Wren wrote again. About 20 minutes after his impromptu birthday party, Hugh was called to Chief Monroe's office for actual business. He leaned back,
already knowing where this conversation was going.
I've got to leave for lunch in 15 minutes, the chief said, with Harry Van Geld.
Hugh raised his brows, playing dumb. The selectman?
Yeah. I understand his kid was picked up last night. What can you tell me?
Well, Hugh said, he's an asshole, for one.
That's not going to help me explain to his father why he was written up.
DUI, Hugh said, but he refused to blow.
How come he was stopped?
He took the corner too fast and hit the curb. It was 2 a.m. Kept saying his dad was going to have my job. I didn't even know who the hell he was, at first, until I put two and two together.
The chief steepled his hands on the desk.
So we could amend the charge to reckless operation if we don't have enough for a DUI?
Hugh grimaced.
If you want to go that route. What's that supposed to mean?
He was drunk, chief. Hugh shrugged. He reeked of alcohol, and he's got a reputation.
He felt his phone buzz in his pocket and silenced it with the push of a button.
What about video?
Hugh shook his head.
It's been down in the cruiser for a week, still trying to get it fixed. So, no breath test, no video. And we know that Van Geld is a dickhead who's going to be pissed if we charge his kid with a DUI.
He frowned at Hugh.
What? What? What's to look for? You're acting like I just said I'm going to drown your puppy. If the kid had blown a 3.0, that would be one thing, but he didn't. And you don't have a BAC. He might have been drunk. He definitely was reckless. Consider it erring on the side of caution. We don't need heat from the select board. It's not worth it. Do me a solid here, Hugh. Amend it before the arraignment.
Because he didn't kill anyone last night? Hugh asked.
How about tomorrow?
His phone vibrated again. Chief Monroe stood up and grabbed his sports jacket.
Consider yourself lucky that you don't have to have lunch with his father.
Guess that's why you make the big bucks.
Hugh leaned back in his chair.
Keep the town running smoothly for me, will you? The chief said.
He had a habit of taking his lunches with the radio chatter turned low, trusting the daily run of the station to Hugh when necessary.
Hugh shook his head.
The guys are going to feel like you sold them out, he said as the chief walked through the door. Not if you explain it to them, Monroe called back over his shoulder.
Hugh shook his head.
Definitely above my pay grade, he muttered.
He stood up and reached in his pocket for his phone.
Stand by for a code red message.
The voice of the dispatcher piped through the intercoms of the building. Hugh let his phone drop back into his pocket. From the window of the chief's office, he saw Monroe's car pull out of the lot. Be advised, we have an active shooter incident taking place at the corner of Juniper and Montfort. All sworn members are to report to the command post at 320 Juniper, the Pizza Heaven parking lot, and await further instructions. All responding members are to ensure they have their body armor. This is an active shooter situation. I repeat, all sworn members are to report.
Hugh didn't hear the rest of the announcement. He was already running out the door.
Louis was writing down notes in Joy Perry's file when Harriet came back into the procedure room. She had settled the patient in recovery and had moved the products of conception to the lab room where she would do a second review. Now she started stripping the paper from the examination table, getting it ready for the next patient. You can never say that their nurses didn't work their asses off, that's for sure.
You got any Halloween candy?
Harriet laughed.
If you keep taking my stash, there won't be any by the time it's
Whatever she said faded away as a rain of bullets exploded outside the procedure room.
Louis grabbed Harriet and pulled her down to the floor behind the examination table. He put his finger to his lips for silence. He should have closed the door. Why hadn't he closed the door? He knew right away what was happening. This was the nightmare that he couldn't remember when he woke up in a cold sweat. This was the boogeyman, all grown up. This was the other shoe dropping. It was not that he had obsessed about violence as an abortion provider, but he had been aware of the possibility. He had had colleagues who were hurt. Louis couldn't let himself worry over what might happen to him if he was going to keep doing his job. He knew abortion doctors who wore masks to work to conceal their identities. He had never wanted to be one of those people. What he did was honorable and just. What he did was human. He wasn't going to hide. It was not that he had naively believed this day might not come. In 1993, an arsonist had burned down the center, and Vanita had had to rebuild. In 1998, after the abortion clinic in Birmingham was bombed by Eric Rudolph, Louis had gone to offer his support. He remembered the ATF mapping out the trajectory of the bomb, which had been full of nails, pink string, pulled tight from where the bomb had been placed to every chair in the waiting room and the receptionist's desk. A spider's web of intended damage. And yet he had listened to the phone ring as new appointments were made and had watched women march right past news trucks to have their abortions. After that, Vanita had contemplated putting bulletproof glass around the reception desk, like her husband had told her to do. But if the patients were strong enough to push past the protesters who told them they were going to hell, shouldn't the staff be brave enough to meet them face to face? Now, Louis was shaking, hard. He tried to hear where the shots were being fired, if they were getting closer, but there was a strange distortion in the sound. It wasn't, he thought, like the movies made it out to be. On the heels of that, this was a fact he wished he had never had to learn. On his first day at the center, Louis had arrived early. He walked across the parking lot, where he ran into a little old lady carrying a chair. "May I?" he asked, taking it from her. She thanked him, and a few hundred feet later said that this was her spot. Louis unfolded the chair and realized he was smack in the center of a group of protesters. He walked away and ducked into Lenny's sub shop across the street, where he ordered a chicken salad sandwich and a Diet Coke and sat at the counter. A few minutes later, he realized that someone was standing at the window taking his picture. The old lady he'd helped. "Do you know her?" the waitress asked, and Louis said no, he had never been in Mississippi before today, but that he worked across the street at the center. The waitress rapped on the window.
"If you ain't buying anything, stop loitering," she said. She turned to Louis. "Those people need to mind their own business," she said.
When Louis finished his sandwich, the old lady was waiting for him. She followed him across the street, shouting the whole time.
"You should be ashamed of yourself. You're not a real doctor. You're a butcher."
Louis realized two things that day, that the waitress might not be an abortion doctor or even go to a pro-choice rally, but she was an activist all the same, and that you could not underestimate an anti. Had that sweet old grandma wanted to, she had been close enough to shank him. When he had gotten inside the center that day, he had broken out in a sweat. For the past 10 years, he had been careful. He didn't leave the building until the end of the day. He ordered food in. As long as he stayed in the center, it was a safe space. Until now. Harriet was crying. Her hand shook as she reached for her phone and typed out a text. To her husband, maybe? Her kids? Did she have kids? Why didn't Louis know that? Louis's phone was locked up in Vanita's office, along with his wallet. Who would he contact anyway? He had no family left, no significant other, for this very reason. Because it was enough that he put himself on the front lines every day, doing the work he did. It wasn't fair for someone else to suffer by sheer proximity. Dr. King's words